Good afternoon, everybody. Hi. Thanks for showing up. My pleasure to talk to you about this stuff. I haven't been to Perimeter in a long time, and the last time I was telling Robert, it was totally dark the whole time, so it's nice to actually see the place. So this is from Notre Dame. You got to get used to the American pronunciation of things. Notre Dame's the cathedral. Yeah, exactly. It sounds better, but that no one will know what you're talking about. So this is going to be a Hilbert series for effective field theory. Effective field theory, sure, we know these words, use them, know them, love them in particle physics. Hilbert series was something entirely new to me that I've just been playing around with. Probably the most important thing that I'll say is that both of this is done with a student of mine, Landon Lehman, very, very good student. So this will be based on a couple of papers we did last year. And then there's another group, some people at Berkeley and now Yale have been playing around with the same thing. So I'm not on these last couple papers, but on the same sort of topic. So, a little introduction. What is our, you know, Wilsonian picture of field theory? I write down all of the operators that I can, consistent with my degrees of freedom and my symmetries. Just write them all down. Local operators, increasing dimensions. Usual rules apply. If there's no reason to forbid it, you write it down. Dimension 4, 5, 6, et cetera. The reason we care about the lowest dimension operators is that's what dominates infrared physics. So any effective field theory you can throw in, just write in that form. A poster child effective field theory, this is just a standard model. So this is, you know, quarks, leptons, gauge fields, Higgs. Those are my degrees of freedom. That's my symmetry, Lorentz invariants, gauge invariants. I should just write everything down. Low dimension operators, we know, that's standard model, dimension less than 4, but it quickly gets more and more complicated. Dimension 4, yes, we're all very familiar with that. Dimension 5 looks hard, or looks, might think it's complicated. It's actually very easy, just 1, that was a Weinberg operator. Dimension 6, if I'm neglecting flavor indices, 63 terms, this was done in the 80s and again here, but that's really where it had stopped after, you know, 1986. The same student, 2014, using the same techniques that people had done before, just real brute force, cranking through all possible combinations, figured out at dimension 7 that there's really 20 terms. And dimension 8, people had played with, thrown a few terms. Sure, it's easy to say, oh, maybe these are some for specific phenomenology where people are interested in, but no one had systematically done any of this, at least as of October. So sort of based on his little getting his feet wet doing this, the student and I started talking and said, you know, wouldn't this be cool? Could we extend this to dimension 8? Maybe even to all orders? Can we come up with a way where I could just say, here's my field content, here's my symmetries. Tell me all the operators. Could you do this for other EFTs? And not only do we want to know the number, so I just wrote down the numbers, you know, 2, 26, or whatever it was here, it would be really nice to know the field content as well. How many operators are there with Higgs and gauge fields? How many operators are there with fermions? How many other operators with derivatives? So could you say how many operators there are, and what is their content at, you know, 8, dimension 8, all orders, whatever. This gets way more complicated. More fields is more indices, all sorts of ways I can contract things. You might think this gets intractably difficult. In fact, that's why no one had even tried 7. So the answer, which I hope to convince you of, is that yes, you can do all of those things using this algebraic technique known as a Hilbert series. So that's a little intro. The outline, what I'll talk about for the rest is, okay, what's the motivation for doing it other than just, you know, it's possible that I could do this. Introduction to Hilbert series, because at least I had never heard of what they are. We'll do some simple examples. Once we understand the most important parts of those simple examples, we'll be able to generalize and write down Hilbert series-like constructions for a standard model effective field theory. That's what the SMEFT is, just all operators with quarks, leptons, Higgses. Derivatives are immediately something people usually ask me about as soon as I talk about counting operators. They're tricky. Once I talk about derivatives, I have integration by parts. I have equations of motion. How do I deal with that? So this is actually pretty easy, doing the first part. Adding derivatives, trickier, but I hope to convince you we can figure that out and then give you that sort of final forms for at least standard model effective field theory 8, 9, 10 dimensions. And there's no reason that it's, you know, restricted to that, just I don't want to bore you with slides of operators. Why? One idea of why you might care about higher dimensional operators is precision. Right? We are, and LHC is going to run next couple decades. It's going to become a precision machine. Higher precision means we can measure couplings to better and better accuracy. Yes, we can parameterize deviations from couplings from their standard model values in terms of higher dimensional operators. So the better we go, sensitive to higher and higher dimensional operators. So this is sort of the lay of the land right now. This is how Higgs couples to vector bosons. This is how Higgs couples to fermions. That's the standard model. Take all the measurements in there together. We sort of get this little black ellipse. I can parameterize deviations from one, which is the standard model value. These are sort of normalized that way with higher dimensional operators. Here's dimension six. You know, here's my usual Yukawa term. I just staple on something else. It's dimension six. So as we get to higher and higher precision, we get to sensitivity to things like this. So if I was to put an operator like this in and an operator like this, if I was to square that, this is dimension six squared. Dimension six squared, it's got the same dimensional power counting as dimension eight. So dimension eight is going to be relevant sometime soon in the LHC sort of precision era. There's also new effects. We know about accidental symmetry. Sometimes lowest dimension or lower dimensional operators have accidental symmetry, you know, baryon number, lepton number, that aren't there because of the gauge symmetry, they're just accidental. And higher dimensional operators are the first place where they're violated. So it could be that even though it's a small effect, suppressed by a lot of powers of some scale, it's the first time some discrete or some new symmetry is violated. The reason I wanted to do that, however, was because I thought it was cool. So that was why, now how. What is a Hilbert series? So we're going to walk through a sort of simple, overly simple example and go way beyond what you would need to do in order to write down what I'll call the Hilbert series, which I'll define in a second. But as we sort of dissect that simple example, we'll see how to generalize it to more and more complicated fields, fermions, gauge fields, other groups, etc. So imagine I just take a simple setup, which has got a scalar, charge scalar. It's got charge plus or minus one. And I say, write down every invariant operator with that field content. And just forget derivatives for a second. We'll definitely talk about them. Well, that's easy. All invariants are just of the form phi star phi to some power n. That's it. There's only one invariant. There's only one way I can do that. So the Hilbert series, a little step into the abstract, is just defined as a series. K kappa to the n, tn. This is the number of invariants. So if there's one at degree two, this would be one. If there's three at degree three, this is three. That's the number of invariants, and these are the actual invariants. Okay, translated to the knowledge or the language that we actually care about, the degree is going to be the mass dimension. So it's going to be the number of operators at dimension two, three, four, etc. And T is going to be symmetry invariant operators. So if I expand this out for my simple phi star phi example, there is my Hilbert series. There's one operator, the one here telling me there's one at phi star phi, one at phi star phi squared, one at phi star phi cubed. I could have just written this as, you know, t, t squared, t cubed, et cetera, but I'm actually writing down the field content in addition to the number. So we want to do this in general, have this be, you know, standard model fields. How many are at four? How many at five? How many, et cetera? So that's really easy. There's only one, so this is overly simple. Now, if instead of treating phi and phi star as complex or as scalar fields, let me forget that they're scalar fields. Just call them complex numbers that stand for those fields, complex numbers modulus less than one. Then these are just numbers, right? Then I can sum that, right? Just sum that. This one over one minus phi star phi is the den generates this whole series. It generates this, each with coefficient one. So if I expand this out to however how far I've expanded it, and I look at the coefficient of whatever the nth term in that expansion is, that's how many operators. Now, it's pretty boring here because it's just one. It will get more complicated. Let me rewrite that, right? This one over one minus phi star phi. Again, we're going way beyond what you would need to do to find all the invariants for this theory, but we'll get to a form that's easiest to extend. I can just write this as an integral over theta here. Right? Sure, you just got to trust me that if I do this, we're going to be doing a bunch of complex, you know, analysis in this talk, but it's all fairly simple. We can do it. Let me change variables to z. Then this is a contour integral. Z is e to the I theta. Looks like a contour integral around one. There are some poles here. I would pick those poles up. When I resolve the contour integral, I'm going to get back this form. So we did all this other stuff, get something more complicated. We'll see why in a second. Immediately at this stage, we see there's two pieces, right? I would call this one piece, everything but the dz over z, and that's another piece. So let's look at them each individually. Let me look at first the stuff in blue. If I expand that all out, I'm going to get not just the invariants are things with no powers of z, but I get things with all powers of z. Right? Here's the terms that I get. They have no z's in. There's a z with phi times phi star psi, phi star phi squared, et cetera. Same thing the other way around here. So that integrand, not quite the integrand, everything that was in that blue box, that generates all combinations of phi and phi star, not just the ones that have equal numbers of phi and phi star. The generating functional, or generating function, excuse me, for all polynomials in phi and phi star. We can group them by their charges. The one that has extra phi, you know, phi was something with plus one charge, it's got an extra z hanging out in front of it. And the ones with an extra phi star, they have an extra one over z. So that thing in blue, expanded out, generated all possible combinations. What that contour integral doing, dz over z, is picking out only the top term. Right? That's the only term that has just a pole at zero. So we have two things. The dz over z, that's the contour integral picking out things at zero. And we're sort of integrating over that with this integrand that generates all possible combinations. So we can see that if I was to change and not integrate dz over z, I could project out a different combination from that generating function. If I had done dz without the 1 over z, that picks out this combination, the extra phi. If I had done dz over z squared, that would pick out the combination with an extra phi star. So it seems like this is giving us everything we want, and I can choose exactly which piece of all possible polynomials I project out by playing with this integral. So, generating function for all polynomials in phi and phi star. You can manipulate this even further. I promise this is the last place that we start screwing around with a simple example. Right? I can write those 1 over somethings as e to the minus log of something, and I can write that log as a series. This is the form that will be the most useful. Right, these power over r, that's sums to the r. This form is called the plethystic exponential. This has been known in the math literature for 100 years by people like Hilbert. This object, we can recognize a couple of things that are in this sum. We're going to play around with this exponential a lot, so you'll see this, you know, symbol or PE a lot. There are fields. Remember, they're not fields. They're really complex numbers that we're using as placeholders for fields. They're complex numbers less than 1. And so I want to be able to manipulate them and sum them. So we had a phi, we had a phi star. And each of those is accompanied by its charge. Remember, z was really e to the I theta. That's how something with charge plus 1 would transform minus I theta. It's a 1 over z. So in this exponential, we get a little grouping, object and its charge, object and its charge. Now, there's two groups, two things. Remember, this generating function, and then there was the dz over z piece. So we don't want to confuse those, so we'll use this little system here. Plethystic sounds to me like it's got to be some kind of dinosaur. I don't know why, so we'll just use this to stand for that 1 over stuff. This generates all of those polynomials. So we had stuff that generates all polynomials, and we use integrating over a measure. We'll see exactly why that's a real accurate term to use there, to project out the stuff that we want. So I'll refer to, you know, dinosaur piece or PE piece. That's that generating function. Okay, that was a lot of work on a very simple example. Let's go to one slightly more complicated example. Two fields, complex fields. Some have charge plus or minus 1, some have charge plus or minus 2. There are 4 invariants that I could write down. You know, this times this, this times this, this squared times this, this squared times this. 4 different invariants. You might think all invariants are just all the polynomials in this, 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 and this all together. Whoops. That was how I got all powers of just phi star phi, so why don't I just repeat that for all 4 of my invariants? Done. You might think that that works. It does not. What that misses is there's actually a relationship among invariants. here's one of them square, or here's two of them times together, they're actually equal to the product of, so if this was the third invariant times the fourth invariant, is actually the first one squared times the second. If we had just done the numerator, the denominator here, that's gonna overcount, because it's not taking that into account. That all of my invariants aren't independent. These are exactly the kind of thing that we want to make sure that we're accounting for. Things like equations of motion, exactly kind of smell like this. This term is a syzygy. So if you ever need to impress somebody with a word with three Y's and two Z's, or no, a one Z, sorry, not that complicated, a syzygy. Okay, I didn't get it just sort of naively guessing from what I knew in my simple example. If you do this with this platistic exponential, you get the correct term automatically. How did we do this? This is exactly what our field was before. One field of charge plus or minus one. All I did when adding a new field was extend this exponential. Here's a field with charge 2. It would go to e to my I 2i theta, so it gets a z squared. Here's a field with charge minus 2. So the same pattern is again. Object, again, complex number standing for a field, charge, object, charge, object, charge. Just put them in. I can go ahead and do that sum. That's going to give me logs, right? It's not that these sums were hard. We're just rewriting it in this convenient form. That's going to give me logs. E to the logs is going to be 1 over stuff. This is going to give me a giant contour integral. The dz over z, this part here, we're still looking for poles in this integral. Now, z is a complex number less than 1, as are phi 1 and phi 2. And we can plot all the poles here. We see that they're not all picked up. That's why, upon doing this integration, we get not just the denominator here, but the numerator as well. So this platistic way of doing things, exponential, where I put in objects and their charges, keeps track of these syzygies. And this is not anything new to physics. This isn't anything, certainly not new to me. This was known by Hilbert himself and another mathematician, Molien. This was developed because it did this, because it could figure out the relationships between invariants. So this has been around for ages. It just hasn't sort of leaked its way into phenomenology. They use these things to study invariants of polynomials, things like rings and ideals, which would completely or quickly get me into trouble not knowing what I'm talking about formal math. They have been used in some formal field theory, things like counting BPS states or counting moduli. A whole bunch of these guys developed some of these techniques. Well, all we're asking for is just group invariants. So some people have said, you know, okay, let's step away from these formal applications and try and just count invariants, like flavor invariants. A couple of people playing around here. And that's exactly what I want to do. I want to apply this same trick or the same tool to just find all invariants of quantum fields or of my standard model fields. Right, if this can pick out all combinations of invariants and keep track of the relationship between them, can I just adopt this math and give it, make it spit out all polynomials or all operators that are functions of Q's, UDLE, Higgs's gauge fields, etc. Why can't I use the same thing? All this is just the math projecting out group invariants. Let's apply it to the standard model. This means we have to do a couple of things, most of which are already laid out and people understood. We're just applying them to our complicated example. A couple of them are new. So we have to expand this to larger groups. I was just doing basic scalar fields, charge plus or minus 1 during the U1. I have to go to non-abelian groups and figure out how to do that. I have to deal with anti-commuting objects. We have fermion fields. That was not in any of my simple examples. These two people have certainly played around with. More complicated, I have to incorporate derivatives. My operators are powers not only of fields, but also of derivatives on fields. I have to figure out how to do that, taking into account equations of motion and integration by parts. So, versus other groups, specifically non-abelian groups. So there was my platistic exponential. I took any field or object standing for a field that I wanted to make invariants of, multiplied it by its charge, and just continued. The way to do this to extend to a non-abelian group is to replace this z here with the character of that field's representation. Now, who knows what a character is? Okay, you guys had basically the same level of group theory that I did. You got it once and it was a character and went flying by and never needed to use it. Character is the following. If there's a group, you have a field in a linear representation, just transforms, representation is the matrix times this field, just mixing them up. The character is the trace of that representation. It's invariant under any change of bases, things like that. These are just functions of J complex numbers, where J is the rank of G. Think about an SU2 or a simple rotation matrix. You know, cosine, sine, sine, cosine. If I take the trace of that, it's 2 cosine, which I can write as e to the I theta plus e to the minus I theta, which is z plus 1 over z. So it's just a function of a complex variable. The number of complex variables is the rank of G. So for SU2 and U1, I'm going to need 1 complex number, 2 for SU3, etc. So I'm just going to use the same thing, object times charge, except instead of the charge, we put the character. So if it's a doublet, it gets a doublet character. If it's a doublet with hypercharge, it gets a doublet, one complex number expressing the character under SU2, and another one for U1. So let's play around a little bit more with this. The characters for U1 are just z to the q, where q is a charge. Well, that makes sense. That's exactly what we saw in our simple examples. Here's a field with charge 1. Here's a field with charge 2. So that's the character for U1. Go to SU2. Characters are functions of one variable because SU2 is rank 1. If it is a doublet, this is the character, z plus 1 over z. Again, this z is going to be a different complex number than what I'm using for this group. I'm just using z to represent anyone. If it's a triplet, here's the character. If it's an SU3 triplet, that's a function of 2 complex variables. SU3 has rank 2. 2 complex variables. And if I say object is charged under multiple groups, its character is just the product of its characters under the individual groups. So a quark doublet has an SU3 character like this, times an SU2 character and a U1 character. And I just form the product of them and I have the total character. Yeah?
What happens with the quantum integration when you go to multiple sets?
I'm going to have quantum integration in multiple variables.
That all works out in the same kind of way.
It does work out in the same kind of way. I'm just looking for poles in a multidimensional complex space. So, the next thing, I have that dz over z. I have to extend that. What happens when that's going to other groups? That becomes an object known as the Haar measure. We're always dealing with complex groups here, or I mean compact groups, SU2, SU3. And I can write the volume of the group as an integral over some of these J complex variables. So in SU2, I can write as an integral over 1 complex number. SU3 is an integral over 2. This is called the Haar measure, sometimes the volume of a group. So for SU2, you just look these things up. I'm not deriving them at all. We're just adjusting. This is the measure for U1. This is the measure for SU2, SU3. So if I have objects that are charged under all of them, I'm going to have to integrate over the volume of SU3 and the volume of SU2 and the volume of U1. All of that's going to help me project out the total invariance. Why does this work? It works because these characters, the things I just told you were, you know, z plus 1 over z for a doublet of SU2, those form, if they're provided they're characters of a complex or compact Lie group, those form an orthonormal basis set of functions for, provided those functions are of J complex variables. So for SU2, functions of one complex variable, the characters form an orthonormal basis set. That means here's character, here's complex conjugate. If I integrate over the volume, get 1. So that is, you know, doublet times doublet integrated over SU2 gives me 1. Doublet times triplet over S integrated over SU2 gets me 0. Because they're an orthonormal set of basis functions, I can expand any function in terms of them. So I can take any function of z and write it as some constant times each one of those characters. So I can take a general function of z and write it as a singlet times a singlet character plus a doublet times a doublet character plus a triplet character, etc. And since all of these are orthonormal, I can project them out. This sounds a lot just like, it's exactly Fourier series. Fourier series, sines and cosines, an orthonormal set of functions theta, right? What do we do? Fourier series. Okay, I have any function of theta. I can write it. Coefficients times e to the I theta, or like this, if I want. Any function expanded, these are orthonormal functions. I can project out any coefficient I want by, you know, integrating over d theta. Right, so if I just integrate d theta, I get this one, the one that has no sines or cosines. If I was to integrate and slap in powers of cosines or sines, I could get at these, just Fourier series. In fact, Fourier series is just character orthonormality for U1 characters. It's exactly the same group theory thing is this thing. There's nothing different. So, what am I going to do? Let's pretend I have something that's only charged under SU2. SU2 is our only group. I take all of the fields, all of their characters, I shove them into this platistic exponential, which means I'm raising each of them to some power, field to the R power, character to the R power, summing over R, etc. Just plug them all in there. This is a function, if I said it's only of SU2, it's all a function of a single complex variable. So I can write it just as a whole bunch of coefficients times characters, A times singlet plus B times doublet plus C times triplet, etc. If I integrate over the measure here, this is going to project out only the singlet, right? We know that the character for the singlet is just one. So in doing this integral, it's essentially, here is my function, I'm multiplying by one, puts out only the singlet coefficient in there. So this spits out only the things that are net SU2 invariant. Why? Because we can write that whole big nasty exponential as a series, just coefficient times represent or times character, and the characters are orthonormal, so I can project out whichever one I want. This easily extends other groups. I just take the total character for a field. So instead of being just as SU2, I have to put in a complex variable for SU2, two complex variables for SU3, et cetera, et cetera. This becomes a big, nasty function. But this big, nasty function, I can always write as a series, coefficients times a set of representations. And I can project out by integrating over the total volume. In the standard model, this would be SU3, SU2, and U1. Integrating over that volume, I would project out only the things that are invariant. So we can do an example. Only the things that are invariant under all groups, the overall singlet. Do an example. Here's an easy example that we really don't need this machinery to do. Just put in a single Higgs with those charges. All right, these charges dictate what the characters are, right? Higgs is a doublet of SU2. I know what the doublet character is. Hypercharge minus a half. I know what the hypercharge character is. I slap that into that exponential. It looks like this, right? Here is Z is a complex number that I'm using to parameterize SU2. U is the complex number for U1. So here's my Higgs. Here's its complex conjugate. I plug that into this platistic exponential, which means e to the log with, or e to that sum. That's this nasty mess here. Then I integrate over the volume, right? Here's the volume of SU2. Here's the volume of U1. That's going to project out only the total invariance. Well, I didn't need this math to tell you what the total invariants are. We know 1 plus h dagger h plus h dagger h squared plus h dagger h cubed, right? But we can just continue this, put in any number of boson fields with different rep charges under whatever gauge groups, and this is guaranteed to work. Next complication, fermions. Fermions are asymmetric, right? We had to include that they're anti-symmetric under interchange. And they're also transformed under the Lorentz group. Right? Scalars, I didn't have to worry about that. Asymmetry, very easy. These guys already had figured it out. You just have a different generating function, just has instead of 1 over r, this is this platistic exponential. For scalars, this was just 1. All we do for fermions is put in a minus 1. That, so when I sum this, instead of getting 1 over 1 minus something, it's just going to get me 1 minus something. But the rest of it is the same. Here is the field, or a complex number I'm using to represent the field. Here's the character, raise them to a power, sum. Very easy. Lorentz group. Fermions are left-handed, right-hand, they're all at two-dimensional representations in Lorentz group. One thing you might worry about is that character orthonormality, what I was using to say I could write any function as the series and then project out coefficients, that required the group is compact. Lorentz group isn't compact. However, we don't care about any dynamics. All I want to do is count invariants, so I can just work in Euclidean space and treat my, you know, Lorentz symmetry as just two extra SU2s. I know how to do SU2s. That means I'm gonna put in my fermion. It's now gonna have an SU2 left or right character in addition to its SU2 gauge character, SU3 gauge character, U1 gauge character. Then I can just proceed exactly as I was doing before. It just looks like two more symmetry groups, two more volumes I have to integrate, two more kind of characters I have to put in. Nothing else changes. For simplicity, just use left-handed fermions. So, Q, U, conjugate, D conjugate. Just looks like they have two extra, or in this case, one extra group that we have to include in this whole mathematical machinery. Gauge fields, no different. Right, we haven't talked about covariant derivatives, we will in a second. I do have to have field strengths, right? Field strengths, I want them to work in a nice, simple representation Lorentz group. To do that, I work with these guys, which are in 1,0 or 0,1. But otherwise, the game is the same. These gauge fields have characters now under SU2 left and SU2 right, the Lorentz group, plus whatever gauge charges, but I just treat them as before. So I can put all the pieces together, put all my standard model fields in. I have a bunch of fermions. They go in the platistic exponential that it has that -1 in it. These are all multiplied by their characters for the groups that we care about, Lorentz, SU3, SU2, U1. Do the same for all scalars and field strengths. So these things individually, generating all possible polynomials of these guys. This is doing all possible polynomials of these guys. This measure is projecting out only the group invariants under Lorentz and gauge. This expression will generate all polynomials or all operators, all invariants with one flavor of QUDLE. Higgs gauge fields, provided there's no derivative. You can do this to arbitrary mass dimension, and this is right. There are no derivatives, and you don't care about that, this will count the number of dimension 52 operators if you really care about that. And you're just done at this bit. If you want to put in more than one flavor, that is very easy. I just stick an NF, or that's the number of flavors, carries along here. So if I want to do NF quarks, there's an NF there. I can do multiple Higgses, same thing, multiple fermions or leptons. In the end, this is just a huge contour integral, right? Over all these complex variables. One complex variable for SU2 left, one for SU2 right, one for SU2 weak, one for U1, and two for SU3. Gigantic contour integral. Finding all the poles for that is impossible or very, very, very difficult. So instead, we just weight each field or each complex number standing for a field by its mass dimension, expand the whole thing out to whatever order mass dimension you care about. When you've done that expansion, all the poles sit at zero. Poles at zero are much easier to find than at some random spot in this circle with radius zero. So by doing this, you can carry this out to whatever mass dimension you want, easily find all the poles, Mathematica can do it in a few seconds, and you're done. We use the standard model effective field theory just because that's the thing on the top of my head. But it certainly will work for any set of fields, provided they're in linear representations of the group. I highlight linear because this character orthonormality only applies to linear representations. But we could do this and put in whatever field you want. You can do SU5 invariants. You can do any arbitrary theory. If you just care about the fields with no derivatives or operators with no derivatives, this will always tell you the number of invariants. Quick example that's less trivial. Let me say, how many operators are there of the form QQQL? So with just Qs and Ls, if I put in three flavors. So here we go, following our usual recipe. There's no Higgses or anything, so forget those. I have to take the field content, quarks. There's three flavors, so it gets multiplied by three. Then it's a representation, which tells me what its character is. Under the Lorentz group, left-handed field only, color, SU2 weak, U1, and then I have to put in leptons. Same left-handed fields. This just dictates what the characters are, which are just complex numbers in this huge mess. Here, for example, we've actually written it out. There's this using X and Y for the Lorentz complex numbers parameterizing the Lorentz group, W for SU3. And same for this. Plug it in. I have to integrate over the whole volume, which is now Lorentz group, SU3, SU2, U1, times this mess. If I do this, this is the result that I get. Okay. 57 at dimension 6, 400, 818, 4818 at dimension whatever this is, even more. This is just counting them. I get to tell how many quarks there are, how many lepton fields there are, and how many there are, just plugging into this machinery. This does not tell me how the indices are contracted. If I actually wanted to find all 57, I would have to plug these things in and figure out how to contract the various flavor, SU2, color, et cetera, indices. But it tells me the number and the field content, zero work. Okay, that's all fine. But what about derivatives? If I want to put in operators, they can involve derivatives on fields as well as the fields. Okay, phi to the end, but I can also have derivatives. If I have to have all powers of phi, example scalar field, included in my operator set, I want all powers of, you know, d mu phi, et cetera, et cetera. This doesn't look too terrible. The derivative, that's just a Lorentz 4 vector. Doesn't carry any gauge fields or anything like that, or gauge charges. So it doesn't look too terrible. Why don't I just add that in as another thing that I'm counting polynomials in? Well, even at order d squared, there are complications. Because if I take two derivatives and act on a scalar, there's actually two ways that I can do that, right? I can have the antisymmetric or the symmetric product. That's a 1-1 of my SU2 times SU2 Lorentz. Or I can have, you know, box phi. So does that mean I have to put this into my exponential and this and one derivative? How do I deal with this? Well, problem is that any polynomial containing powers of box phi, I can always reduce by the equations of motion. So here's an example, m powers of phi times box phi. Box phi I can always reduce to some polynomial. This is just for an example theory, but I can always turn this into just another polynomial of just fields and no derivatives. That's what the equations of motion do. All right? So if I have a whole bunch of polynomials and that involves phi and box phi, the box phi ones are redundant. They're not doing anything new for me because I'm already generating all polynomials in phi. And if all polynomials involving a box phi can always revolve into a polynomial with phis, redundant. So what I really want to do is just not allow this term in that exponential. I want to put in single derivatives of phi, the symmetric derivatives of phi, but I want to forbid box phi because that's redundant. So any polynomial in phi and box phi is the same as any polynomial in phi. Remember, I'm not telling you the coefficients in front of the operators. All I'm telling you is how many there are. So we can deal with the equations of motion by just saying that thing never shows up. How do we do with this more mathematically? Well, here is my platistic exponential, that generating function that's going to generate all powers of phi. If I wanted to generate phi and d phi, well, I have to put in d phi. D phi now is in a different representational Lorentz group. So here phi singlet, d phi is a 4 vector. At d squared phi, I could have this term again, but that would be box phi. I forbid that and only write the 1-1 term. That's the symmetric product of the two derivatives. Same happens at 3 derivatives, same happens at 4 derivatives. We always only allow the totally symmetric product because anything else is redundant by the equations of motion. So this will give me all powers in phi, d phi, d squared phi, et cetera, accounting for the equations of motion. Same story for fermions. What is d times a fermion? Well, here's 4 vector acting on a fermion. 4 vector on a left-handed fermion gets me a right-handed fermion plus something in the 1/2-1 representation. Equations of motion. Here's the equations of motion for a left-handed fermion, at least in a sort of a standard model type setup. This guy is some component in within here. This stuff on the right-hand side is always in a right-handed fermion, right? This stuff only contains 1/2 0 parts, right-handed fermion, right-handed fermion. So equations of motion, same stuff that said box phi and phi were redundant, says this part of dq is redundant with other things. So if I want to put in derivatives of fermions, I want to omit this just like I've omitted box phi. So here's a actual in practice doing that. Left-handed fermion, single derivative of a fermion, it's only the 1/2-1 piece, part of the product of derivative and phi that isn't in the equation of motion, repeat. You can do the same story for gauge fields. Here it is for actually a Higgs. Now in addition, so what used to just be Higgs in that platistic exponential times its characters is now Higgs plus d Higgs plus d squared Higgs. If we do this, you will generate all invariants, all powers of fields and their derivatives that accounts for equations of motion redundancy. You can look at these terms, these derivatives, d1, no derivative, plus 1, plus 2, etc., and you might be tempted to sum that. How do I get all powers of symmetric derivatives? You can actually do this. Whoops. That's what this is, this weird function. So I put this times phi into that platistic exponential and go. And that would generate the single, the zero derivative term, 1, 2, that I showed you. D is a separate spurion. What do I mean by this? Spurion is my word for the complex number that's standing for something that transforms under a group. That means I put in the same D for derivative of a scalar that I put in for the derivative of a fermion. So derivative D is the same. D phi is going to be used for Higgs. It's also going to be DQ. It's the same D. Now, this is nice that we can write things in this way. At a given mass dimension, you don't need to go to all possible orders and derivatives. So really, I could just truncate this if I want. For example, at dimension 8, you know that there are less than 3 derivatives on things. Okay, so in equations of motion, all we did was we said anything that any of those box phi or the d/q parts, we just omit them from my platistic exponential. But other than that, we just go on our way. Plug things in with their characters, expand, and we get all polynomials. Integration by parts is trickier. And what is integration by parts redundancy? Well, I have things here. This would certainly be generated from our platistic exponential, powers of fields, and their derivatives. But they're not all independent. I can integrate by parts on this term, and I'm going to get things like these other terms. Even after I've gotten rid of equations of motion things. So I get times when I have fields that aren't all independent. At the same time, there's some operators which are just totally zero once I've done integration by parts and equations by motion. That's what one of these is. So I've swapped from little d, just normal derivative, to covariant derivative, that zero problem doing that. But I have this problem. How do I get rid of equations of motion redundancy? I have it overcounted, right? I have all powers of fields, their derivatives, but I haven't figured out how to do this yet. What can you do? One, brute force it. This might work for a lower dimension thing like dimension 8. You've overcounted, just work through each one. We tried doing that, student got really angry with me. Better ideas are always better. Okay, well, let's think about how we might do a better idea. Forget the whole standard model effective field theory, because that's got a lot of moving parts. Let's just work with a single scalar field again. So here's my single scalar field. If I didn't care about derivative, it's just that term. I can add in derivatives, that whole fancy sum if I want, or just single derivative, symmetric. This is going to give me a whole series of things that have just single scalar fields, so powers of phi and powers of derivatives. So terms like this, m derivatives, n phis. Well, any term that has m derivatives has to come from a derivative acting on something with m minus 1 derivatives. So I can group operators like this, but anything with this many derivatives had to come from derivative acting on things with one less derivative. So if I know the number of these, that's exactly what this projects out, and I know the number of one fewer derivatives, that's a set of constraints. If everything in here had to come from everything in here, there's a set of constraints I can use to narrow things down. Specifically, the number of invariants, if I account for integration by parts, is the number of terms I have here minus the number of constraints that they have to satisfy. Once I've done that, that should erase this integration by parts redundancy. How do I count terms with one fewer derivative? That's actually very easy. Remember that that platistic exponential doesn't generate just the invariants. It generates all powers. Go back to our series of just phi and phi star. I didn't get just the invariants. I got things with one extra power of phi, two extra powers of phi, etc. So this contains all polynomials, not just the ones that are invariant. And I can project out different pieces. I project out the singlet when I want the Hilbert series. But just like if I have sines and cosines, I can project out the a0. Or I can also project out the coefficient of sine or cosine by multiplying by something different when I integrate. Same goes here. So I can project out the piece of my whole mess that lies in the four-vector representation, which is exactly what that's going to sit in. The thing with one fewer index or one fewer derivative has got one free Lorentz index. That's got to be sitting in the one half representation. So I can pull out exactly how many terms are in here just by manipulation here. Instead of integrating one here against this, so volume of the groups times this exponential, if I put this here, it's going to project out the pieces in here that sit in the four vector, which I called a half a half. That's exactly what I want. This will tell me this is one number of terms like this. Put this in the number of terms like this. So I can just subtract the two, at least according to this, you know, sort of conjecture that we were playing with. Fancier way of writing that is total Hilbert series, things that are totally invariant under all Lorentz groups, gauge groups. Things that are all gauge invariant, but they're sitting in the one half Lorentz representation. That's the, you know, the things with one fewer derivative. And if I put a D here to get the dimensions correct, because this has one fewer derivative, I can just subtract those two. That should get me the number of operators, all fields, their derivatives, accounting for the equations of motion, and integration by parts. In gory detail, here we go again. So here is that thing, all phi and all its possible derivatives. Here is the volume of the Lorentz group, because this phi has no other charges. And then we have one, that's just integrating this, gets me the total invariance, minus, this is going to project out the pieces that are in the one half representation. So that's just gory detail of what I said in words. One issue, if I have more constraints, so more terms at m minus one derivatives than m, what do I do? Well, that tells me there's a negative number of operators. That doesn't seem very physical. So at least when we were first playing around with this, we just dropped that. Said, forget any term that's negative, only count the positive terms. This is a bit ad hoc, admittedly, but it seemed to be working. Did some cross checks with this. We had no reason for this subtraction other than that it just sort of made sense that things from with m derivatives came from things with m minus one derivatives. What checks did we do? This was easily extended to, we played with one scalar, but you can get multiple scalars, fermion scalars, standard model, no problem. Whether or not I swapped in covariant derivatives or not didn't matter. What do I mean didn't matter? If I plugged the standard model into what I just said, dm derivatives minus m minus one derivatives, I got dimension six correct. Takes 2 minutes. If I put in one flavor, three flavors, got that counting completely correct. Got standard model dimension seven correct. We could use that predict dimension eight or higher, which is what we started playing with there. So here's just some examples. Here are just lists of operators. Again, this tells you the number and it tells you the field content. You have to figure out how to contract the indices. For example, there are two fields with two Q dagger squared, Q squared, and a G left-handed. So that's one of the field strength plus or minus, it's dual. You have to figure out how to contract all of the indices. But you know that there's just two. Things with no derivatives, very confident in. One derivative here, you just see the D here. It just floats there because it's the same number we've used for a derivative on any field. You have to go and figure out where to put the derivatives. But you know the number. There was 535 that we got there. Or if we count plus Hermitian conjugate, 931. Issues, even at this level, it was not entirely, in addition to it being sort of ad hoc, it had some issues. These are the number of constraints that we're imposing. If those are not independent constraints, we're over-subtracting, or under-subtracting, or mis-subtracting. So we could definitely identify times where this was not working. You could just can't calculate by hand the number of operators that you were supposed to get, and it wasn't quite matching. This did not show up at one derivative. One derivative was easy to nail. Started to show up, especially when you had four derivatives or so. What we noticed was that whenever we had this problem, that these constraints were not linearly or were not independent, happened when there were multiple ways to partition derivatives. We couldn't know why, but it was just sort of a flag. Anytime that there were multiple ways to partition derivatives meant the constraints were off. For example, if I have six derivatives and four fields, well, I can put two derivatives here, this and this. Or I can still have two derivatives, one and one. So the same partitioning, two, two, one, one, but they're not quite the same. So whenever this cropped up, we saw that algorithm m derivatives minus m minus one derivatives was failing. Didn't know the deep reason of this, but at least we could get the majority, anything with one derivative, two derivatives, three derivatives, that stuff, immediately out of that algorithm. Things with multiple derivatives, whenever we saw this happening, we just brute forced. We said, look, whenever this happens, multiple partitions, that means this is failing, go and check that by hand. That does not mean that there aren't other circumstances where this fails. So we knew there was some sort of rough count that we were getting. So that was what we did in that paper. We just brute forced the things that were not, or that had the potential to screw up. That was where things sat until a few months ago. That's when this group of some people at Berkeley and some people at Yale modified what we were doing, or took what we were doing and sort of found real reason behind it. So this was what we were doing. We're a scalar field. I had this weird all orders derivative thing. That's what this P is. It was when I had summed first derivative plus two symmetric plus three, et cetera, et cetera. I was taking this form, field and all its derivatives, and then doing the total invariance minus the stuff that's sitting in the one half partition. So this was total thing minus d times objects with one fewer derivative. That's what we were doing. Didn't know where that came from, and it didn't always work. They used this instead. So same exact argument, but instead of doing one minus just d, they did one in front of everything else, one minus d plus d squared minus d cubed. They just put more stuff in front. So the things that were screwed up by this partitioning were repaired by adding these extra terms in there. You put this in, this works. Totally free of issues. They found 60 operators that we had missed. We didn't know when we were always subtracting these constraints, when things were not independent. They found that there were 62 extra operators. With this form, they predict 9, 10, 11, 12, and they only did that because after that, it just got boring or too difficult to write down. They found the numbers of there. You can even do an all orders form, and instead of expanding in the mass dimension, you could just write some weird giant contour integral. That's true to all orders. You don't have to expand anything. More importantly than just sort of futzing with what thing to put in front there, they also offered an explanation of where this is coming from. So why putting this in front? Remember, this is the term that they have sit in front of that platistic exponential. Platistic exponential is a function of all its fields and derivatives. And this was just projecting out, or the volume plus this, which is projecting out the right invariance, including equations of motion, including integration by parts. So they find this, and they can explain this by saying, instead of working just in the Lorentz group, let's work and put things into representations of the conformal group. For things in the conformal group, what do we have in conformal group? Well, conformal group, we have primary operators. And then we have descendant operators, which come from just acting on primary operators with a derivative. So within that perspective, integration by parts redundancy is really saying, just keep the primary operators. This could be some combination of fields and derivatives. But just keep that. Anything that can be sort of derived by acting on that with a derivative is a descendant. Get rid of it. In this light, they're going to take products of fields, take only the highest conformal weight combination of operators, and then integrate over the other parts of the conformal group, so the stuff that isn't in the Lorentz, or so the dilatations and conformal transformations. The extra factor you get from this piece, plus projecting out only the highest weight, is exactly this prefactor. So they adjusted the right prefactor. We had sort of guessed it with this ad hoc d derivatives minus d minus one derivatives. They said, no, this is the correct one. And it really comes from this line of thinking of conformal operators taking only the highest weight part, the primary part of any conformal, of any product. So what do we do now? We now have all dimension eight operators. We can study exactly what kind of impact that they're having. I sort of mentioned before, but I'll say it again. Dimension 8 is important because dimension 6 squared has got the same power counting in terms of dimensions as dimension 8. So if you want to study really the impact of dimension 6, as soon as you put in dimension 6 squared, you don't know what you're doing unless you know dimension 8 as well. So we were playing around with this. A process that looks like it might be promising to at least be sensitive to this is PP to associate Higgs production. That's something to play with. Analytic properties, and there's of course other Fino things to do. Analytic properties, this is this weird contour integral. What happens if I go to, instead of finding the full invariance, just find, go to certain poles of this? What do residues of that thing look like? Something I'm interested in doing is also doing this with nonlinear fields, things like, you know, QCD, effective theory of pions, something like that. The pions don't sit in a linear representation, so I can't automatically apply this. How do I manipulate things so that I can? It's something I'm playing with now. So, summarize. We have this machinery all set up now. You give me your symmetry group. You give me the fields that you have and how they transform under any of those symmetry groups. Plug it in, I can tell you what operators there are and their form, how many of what kind of field and how many others, how many derivatives, that are invariant under Lorentz symmetry and gauge symmetry that account for integration by parts and equations of motion redundancy to whatever mass order that you, or mass dimension that you want. All possible. So this platistic exponential, that is a generating function for all combinations. Then we use character orthogonality. That's what was key for picking out the invariants. The derivatives were a little bit tricky, but these issues have recently been overcome. So I say there's lots of interesting directions to play with. So thanks very much. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But I tried that last time and nobody got that joke at all. So I should have done it with you, Robert. People are like, ooh, yeah. So yes, the plesiosaur. Yes,
so
not.
Have you tried different specific things for the area? Because there are people that do effective, when they talk about precision physics, mm-hmm. right? They do this list of
right.
operators.
Yeah, and they are hungry for this, right? Yeah. So we are working with them. The problem is right now you get this list and you don't know how to contract the indices if you actually want to do the Fanau analogy too. So we've taken some subset. What we're doing right now is just Higgs and gauge fields, and we're working out just how all the indices contract. It's actually not that hard once you sort of get the pattern of things.
Yeah.
Other things would be, you know, things that are what adjust T-parameter sort of physics or parity violation kind of physics are more important ones to look at. So yeah, we've got those set at dimension 8. But I mean, there's 60 something dimension 6, and they're confused enough with that. People have huge fights about that. So this, I don't know if anybody wants to touch. But yeah, I mean, why we got into it was,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Do you want?
Do you think that the thing you resolved? I remember it was GGI last year.
I don't know. I think at some point the people have just sort of created the fight because they like the fight rather than actually care about resolving it. Some of the fight is what people call tree level versus loop level. I don't think that will ever get resolved. This is just the operator. I don't care what coefficient you put in front of it. Just here they are. Oh, but yeah, obviously, right? This is just sort of academic, why you can write down all operators. Obviously, we want to try some Fino applications with it. I'm doing this now. But putting the indices in is less fun than just, you know, how many operators are there at whatever dimension.
I've been trying to say, I mean, is this back there? Have you tried to say, sorry, no. Have you tried to see what happens with dark matter?
Yeah, you can absolutely put in another field, no problem. I mean, people have worked out at dimension 6, standard model plus a singlet. You can do that. I mean, people wrote whole papers where that was the subject, dark matter plus a singlet, all dimension 6. This would just spit it out in two lines. I mean, that's another non-linear representations of things, I think, which is why if I figure out how to do that, that would be another cool application of it. At least sort of heavy quark theory, those things aren't transforming as linear representations that I think about. But yeah, that would be absolutely a cool application. So that's sort of where I want to try and make things work, and LHC stuff. But.
Do you have any thoughts on automatically contracting up indices, or is that?
It's actually not that hard once you just start playing with all the possible, well, I don't know, you just get practice at it. Automatically doing it, no, we haven't done that. Not really.
I would think that's doable.
Yeah.
I think it is, right. If you've got enough information going in, I don't think it's that crazy. But yeah, we haven't played with that yet. We've just been, you know, happy to get a crazy number that comes out. But yeah?
People are interested in variables in your observable and
you can't
calculate it.
Yep.
Can I add a requirement to write down all the
Yeah, you can add all sorts of other symmetries or any other constraints that you want. Absolutely. And if you wanted to say, add in powers of fields and Yukawa couplings, for example, you could have Yukawa couplings as just some spurion which has no derivatives, right? So then I could add this in as sort of a non-dynamical object. So you can absolutely add more derivatives if you wanted baryon number or lepton number imposed, or to, yeah, either coupling constants as well, fit in the same format.
So even one
Yep, you can project out, you can say, here's the combination, give me all the things with lepton number -2, comes right out, right? Same thing. All it is changing, right, we've projected out the invariance, you would just change what charge you want to project out instead of the charge 0, -2, +2, whatever, comes right out.
So if there are no questions, then let's thank Adam again.
Thanks.